Welcome to the More Perfect Union, a podcast about the joy that we all get from American politics. My name is Jonah. I am an independent here in Maryland.
And I'm DJ. I am also an independent now here in Virginia.
I'm Kevin. I'm a moderate Democrat living in Los Angeles.
And I am Greg. I am your liberal Democrat from Cincinnati, Ohio.
And you, dear listener, you should like us on Facebook at facebook.com/moreperfectunionpodcast. You should find us on the web at moreperfectunionpodcast.com. You should rate and review us on iTunes. That's really the important part of the whole show, that you take away the rating and reviewing on iTunes. This rest is all sort of frosting. So, when we talk about frosting these days, our minds travel immediately to Bernie Sanders. And
I'm
recently...
Actually, Jonah, I'm still getting over the fact that you acknowledge we only have one listener.
I see those stats. I know who you are, listener. No. So last week was a fascinating conversation in Sanders versus Clinton in the modern state of fans for both of those. But Kevin, today this week you decided to put hard feelings aside and go out and fully endorse the burn, right? You are now a Sanders supporter, publicly representing him.
Well,
out there in the world.
I gave him a fair shot. I decided to go to a Bernie Sanders rally. I'd been to a Hillary Clinton rally once. My state is voting on Tuesday, and I thought it was only fair to give the man the chance to change my mind. I am leaning a little bit towards Hillary Clinton at this point. I know that's going to surprise you guys. But last night I went to a Bernie Sanders event in Los Angeles. And I'll just give you the thumbnail of it. First of all, my estimate was about 7,000 to 8,000 people. I saw in the papers 13,500. No way. So that makes me wonder whether a lot of the crowd estimates that we've seen this year might have been inflated. Not that it makes much difference. That's still a very good turnout, especially given the fact that they had to change the venue at the last minute. So I'm not taking anything away from Bernie on that. Great crowd, really friendly. There was not a problem. There was not a protester. The people that were there were just, they were wonderful. They were upbeat, enthusiastic, obviously, but really, really nice. Now, I did not tell anybody that I happen to lead towards Hillary Clinton.
I was going to say, did you wear your Hillary Clinton, the I'm with her t-shirt? Or
no, I didn't. And at one point, they were obviously selling a lot of Bernie merchandise, which I could, you know, turn down because I, you know, like, no, I'm not going to buy a $10 or $20 t-shirt. But while we were waiting in line, toward the end there, they started giving away free Bernie buttons, and I couldn't say no.
No.
So I had to take a Bernie button and I pinned it on my jeans because I didn't want to wear it on my shirt. But I was wearing a Bernie button at some point last night. So we go, and I was hanging out with some college students online who were really fun, and we were talking about the college and their careers and everything. But we go into this thing, and, you know, it's pretty much, I guess, a lot of people have probably already been to these, but it's kind of what you'd expect. It starts with a band that you've never heard of, and then some young actor that would probably mean something to my 13-year-old daughter, but I'd certainly never heard of him, some TV actor, really good-looking kid that's 25 years old, tried to give what he thought was a stirring emotional speech about political history and the art of electoral politics. Obviously, I found offensive to be lectured to by a kid that is barely out of high school. Then they had another local band. Then Susan Sarandon came out and badmouthed Hillary Clinton for about 3 to 4 minutes. Then Dick Van Dyke came out and was unbelievably great. I mean, he's Dick Van Dyke, and the wonderful thing about Dick, other than his a tremendous talent, is that as a 90-year-old man, he's still as energetic, as lucid, and as optimistic about life as anybody you've ever met. And that was just terrific.
And you, of course, will have been the only person in that crowd who actually knew who he was.
Right. Everyone was like, isn't he a dirty joke or something? Or?
Well, actually, the people next to me yelled, and I swear to you, this is true, they yelled, he's still alive!
They've been chanting that at every Bernie rally, actually.
But, DJ, I could one-up you there. I am almost for certain the only person there that's ever worked with Dick Van Dyke. So there.
Probably true.
Yeah,
and good for you for that, by the way.
Yes, it's Dick an honor Van Dyke, of my life.
Dick Van Dyke was on MSNBC, and not only, I mean, for 90 years old, he was sparring with everyone. He went after Michael Steele making some Dick Van Dyke joke, like, who's Dick Van Dyke? And he just took him to task.
He said something like, take a hike, Dick Van Dyke.
Oh, yeah, that was it.
And that was like a couple of months ago, and apparently Van Dyke saw it. And just kept it in his pocket, but the way he took him on, we're talking about today on MSNBC, was so congenial.
So
it was just great, wasn't it?
Oh, it's like, now I know why I've always loved Dick Van Dyke. But what also I loved was he never said anything bad about Hillary Clinton, except the only thing that was even remotely negative was she's just more of the same. Which he goes, if you like the same. Fine, that's what you're going to get. But he's like, this is it. He was just so positive and uplifting.
Right.
Which, and I don't want to badmouth Susan Sarandon, because I'm sure if we ever have her on the podcast, she'll remember this. she's just really negative person. Just really, for someone who's had a really successful career and really does well, she's just really unhappy, it seems. And just has nothing nice to say about anybody.
And if I could also make one of my famous fashion critiques, because I know you guys know that I'm well known for my Mr. Blackwell fashion critiques.
That's like your hobby. That's like one of your things, right?
But the woman comes on stage in jeans and a hoodie that is pulled over her head. Now, what is a 60-year-old woman doing going to an actual outdoor event wearing a hoodie? Put on a blouse, or at least take the hood off your head when you're speaking. But, okay, so that was my fashion point for today. So anyways, then they all introduced Bernie. Bernie comes out and gives quite an exceptional one-hour speech. Now, was there anything new in it that anyone who's followed this campaign hasn't heard it 500 times? No. It was every soundbite that we've heard, and I won't list them. The only thing he did not mention was Goldman Sachs and the speech transcripts. That's the only golden oldie he didn't play last night. But he had every other point. Tremendously energetic, which surprised me. You know, here's a guy that's been in an 8-month campaign, a grueling campaign on anyone. As you know, I've knocked him for being 74 years old and would be the oldest president if elected. But boy, did he look energetic, crisp. He was just there last night. So kudos to him on that. Last observation, and then you can ask a question, is in terms of the crowd, not only was it tremendously young, I mean, I'd estimate that, and I wrote this on a Facebook post today, maybe 1% of these people had been alive, during the Reagan administration, and maybe 5% of them were born before Bill Clinton ever became president. Really super young crowd, not that Latino, more Asians than Latinos, and almost 100% white. There were just a handful of black faces. I don't even think I saw a handful. I think I saw one. But there certainly were not, he was not well represented in that demographic. Okay, Jonah. Hmm.
Well, I was just going to ask your thoughts on comparing the stagecraft between a Sanders rally and a Clinton rally.
Ooh.
Great question. Just in the way that they're sort of putting on this traveling road show. What's your comparison there?
Great question. I would say, frankly, that they were comparable, although last night's was a better one, and I'll tell you why. First of all, even though there were about 3,500 to 4,500 people at the Hillary thing that I saw, not a small crowd, this one had a bigger crowd, therefore there's more energy. It's an outdoor venue, so it had that going for it. They had opening acts. They had bands that, for the audience that they had was really cool because it was like being at a concert. And, the people that introduced, you're talking about Dick Van Dyke versus Gil Garcetti, I think, introduced her when I was there. And, you know, they had some other very nice young Latina woman that spoke, and another local assembly woman or something. So, and then, frankly, although I would say that they were both comparable in speaking style, the Hillary one that I was at, she actually cut her speech short because there were a lot of protesters that were heckling and trying to break it up, and I think she got a little flustered. So she did only about a 15-minute speech, whereas Bernie did it in an hour.
Wow.
But, you know, we all saw Hillary speak this week on television about Donald Trump, and we'll talk about that later. But certainly, you know, in terms of delivery, neither of them are Bill Clinton, neither of them are Barack Obama, neither of them are Donald Trump. But they both gave, I thought, pretty similar style, you know, pretty rousing speeches.
Did Sanders, I've been reading about this, but did Sanders talk about the violence and condone the violence of at the Trump rallies that's been going on? I mean,
no, that violence didn't come up at all.
Okay, he didn't talk about that at all?
No. Okay. He did hit Trump a lot, though. He did speak a lot more about Trump than he spoke about Hillary Clinton. A lot more.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good. So, and there were no anti-protesters or no Trump? No. Oh.
No. There was, I mean, not that I saw, and I hung out a little bit afterwards as well. It was a love fest, frankly.
Yeah. And, yeah. And this was in Los Angeles, or right?
Yes.
Outside?
So what happened was they were hoping to do it at the Greek, which is a big venue, an outdoor venue here at Los Angeles. It turns out that Hillary Clinton has already booked the Greek for Monday night, and for whatever reason, there was a council person in Los Angeles that apparently stepped in and stopped the Sanders people from getting the license that they needed to hold it at the Greek. By the way, someone who's endorsed Hillary, so that's the new latest scandal. So they had to move it quickly, and this is what was really strange about it. It was at the L.A. Coliseum, which used to be used, I think, probably for the Raiders, or I don't know. Now it's just used for, like, USC games, I think. There's very few actual events there anymore because L.A. has more modern stuff. But they didn't let us into the actual arena where the seats were, where the field was. They kept us on the outer perimeter where you would usually see concession stands. And they just flooded that with people standing, which was really uncomfortable. I mean, I was on my feet for most of 5 or 6 hours yesterday.
Well, chances are, I mean, if they only had like 7,000, they probably didn't want a picture of like a very sparse group.
If they had shown Bernie Sanders addressing a small crowd with a whole bunch of seats empty at the LA Coliseum, it would have been a disaster for him.
Right.
So okay.
That was why that didn't happen.
Okay. Well, it didn't look that great to me, but you know, you guys can Google the pictures and tell me what you think. But anyways, I just wanted to speak about that. That was my day at a Sanders campaign, and obviously didn't change my opinion. But there were points when I was listening to him when I was thinking, you know, if he had gotten into the race a little earlier before I had already kind of landed on Hillary. And if he hadn't been a socialist, which bothers me tremendously, and we're not going to go into that, but I'm just talking for me,
yeah,
you know, if
yeah,
to the point where we're like, if I thought he could have won a national campaign, you know, how would I have come down on that choice between the two?
You know,
and I have to say, I'm still a Hillary person, but I have to say, you know, I understand the attraction.
And if zebras didn't have black and white stripes,
right, right,
you know, they just might be horses.
Right.
Yeah, there's like all those kind of fundamental things.
Right.
I've said this before. He's not a bad human being. He's not a bad candidate. What he's done has been pretty good. It's just we're ready for him to gracefully exit now. So.
Well, I will be nasty to him later in this podcast when we talk about the state of the race. But for now,
well, let's talk
I'll
about what happened this weekend.
What did happen this weekend?
Well, we had not only the Puerto Rican primary today, but the Virgin Island caucus, which, speaking of things that were nasty to Sanders, did not go so well for him. And in fact, I don't have the official call on Puerto Rico, but I have unofficially that it went towards Hillary. Is that, did you guys?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, the networks have already called it.
And as a matter of fact, I have the numbers on CNN right here. It's why my internet is so damn slow tonight. with 38% in so far, Mrs. Clinton has 62.5%, roughly, and Sanders has 37.5%, roughly. So CNN's already called it for Mrs. Clinton, which probably makes sense. She's been over 60% all night. And this is really a reminder, if we needed one, which we didn't, of Sanders' biggest problems: African American voters, or in this case, African Caribbean voters, if you will, and voters of various Hispanic descents. They have never come around to him. He has done well with certain segments of white Democrats. He has done well with certain segments of Asian American Democrats. Is probably why you saw some at the rally yesterday, Kevin. But African Americans and Hispanic Democrats have never warmed to him. For their own reasons, they have warmed to Mrs. Clinton. I think one of the reasons is, frankly, Hispanic Democrats and African American Democrats are more moderate than white Democrats, and that shows up in their primary voting patterns. And we're probably going to see this on Tuesday, where Mr. Sanders will do probably very well in Northern California, which is whiter than the southern half of the state, in at least last I checked. Maybe it's changed. and Mrs. Clinton will do very well in the southern half of the state that is more diverse, but especially has more Hispanic and African-American Democrats. And that's why I still think that she's going to win California, for what it's worth. I understand that Sanders is upset that he's not doing well. I don't know whether he has... and again, I haven't seen on the internet, but he may very well complain that that the process is rigged because Cuba was not allowed to elect delegates. But the simple fact of the matter is... Nor was Nicaragua, exactly. But... You know, we don't, it is, again, just another reminder that while Sanders does very well with white Democrats and is competitive with Asian American Democrats, he's never been competitive with African American Democrats or Hispanic Democrats, and it's going to show up again on Tuesday.
Yep. And, you know, the crux of this campaign has always been, who can claim that the other person's demographic groups are going to flock to them in a November election? So Hillary has always said, look, okay, I'm not doing so well with young people right now, but and maybe with the liberal base, but they will come around to me when I am the Democratic nominee and I am their choice against a conservative Republican. Sanders has always maintained, in essence, okay, so even though I thought I would be doing better with minorities, the African Americans and Latinos at this stage of the race, even though I haven't brought my numbers up quite where I thought they were, they will find me when I am the nominee, and they will vote for me because I am not the Republican conservative choice. I think that her claim on the young people is much more valid than his claim on the minority vote, but it's academic. We'll never know. So, you know, only one of them is going to be the nominee. But my concern has been all along, aside from the fact that I think that they would tear him up mercilessly for his political history, the Republicans would if he ever got the nomination. My concern is that he would not turn out minorities to the extent that we need to win a national election. Yes, he'd probably get the majority of that vote, but the turnout would suffer because there's just no enthusiasm for him.
And I would say this is actually part of and this is just from my perspective looking at it from the outside, Marxists, and you know, Bernie is a Marxist of some kind, and I don't necessarily mean that as pejorative. Social Democrats in Europe have a Marxist inspiration, and a number of them are actually fairly decent politicians who run their countries well. But Marxists in America have never been able to figure out African Americans. And if Bernie Sanders is any indication, they're having trouble figuring out Hispanic Americans, too. They don't quite seem to understand racial and ethnic consciousness. And in fact, Marxism tends to think those things are false consciousnesses, if I have their terminology correctly. And this is just another example of Democrats of color, center-left Americans of color, whatever you want to call them, basically saying, no, Karl Marx is a German who didn't understand us then, and his followers don't understand us now.
Yeah.
Right. Without a doubt. Time and time again, we've seen different groups, different minorities, come to Sanders and say, these are issues that we are concerned about. Racial issues, poverty issues, things like that. And he always says, well, you know, it all comes back to economics, and it all comes out, and they're like, wait a second, that's not what we're talking about. And he always goes back to his wheelhouse, the things that he feels comfortable with. And there's a, I feel, and I've seen this, a large dissatisfaction with these answers that, you know, they're not seeing in his answers.
Right. Right. And yeah. his predecessors have had trouble with those answers for generations.
Yeah. Yeah, without a doubt.
So we have, you know, what I'm calling Super Duper Tuesday coming up this Tuesday. There are six states that will be voting. California is, for some reason that I'm not exactly sure of, the big enchilada, the big prize that everybody's talking about, as if New Jersey is not an important state, as if swing state New Mexico is not an important state.
South Dakota,
because, you know, George McGovern
was
from South Dakota.
Don't turn your back on South Dakota.
We know where you sleep.
And, of course, North Dakota and Montana, so that rounds out the six.
Well, you know, what's interesting is if the news stations call New Jersey and South Dakota, I mean, they could call that all well before the polls are closed for California, and that could radically alter the voting in...
Nah.
I agree. I think that if... I mean, New Jersey will be closed by... In California time, what is it, like 5 o'clock, 4 o'clock?
Right, right. And the polls here are open till 8, so there's 3 more hours.
So, and these people aren't off work, and there's a large section. And if it's already called that Hillary Clinton will only need 30 delegates?
No, she's gonna need about 15 by Tuesday morning.
Right.
She's going to need 15 to 20 by Tuesday morning.
Well, she's going to have them by... She'll have them.
Yeah, yeah. She's going to win them when, you know, when
she'll
New Jersey
by
closes.
Noon.
Yeah, yeah.
If
so here's the thing. I mean, it'll be over. So if I was a Sanders like fan, but not super fan, and I'm like, well, I could go vote for Sanders, but it's not going to matter. Oh, Hillary's already won. I'm not going to go. You're going to
lose
this.
Let me say that. If Bernie loses California by anything under 5 points, they will certainly claim that that depressed their vote, whether it did or not.
Let me ask you this, Kevin, about California.
Yes.
I've seen stories, like on West Wing, like fictionalized political stories.
By the way,
about
soon to be your home.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
What we've seen stories about how something has happened during a national election and some ripple effect has caused something to happen so that California eventually doesn't go the way that it would have gone if it hadn't rained or something. In your memory of national elections, has there ever been an instance of something happened on the East Coast and therefore the West Coast did something different? Like,
yes.
Is there any evidence of people just not showing up to vote because of that?
Yes, it hasn't changed California, I don't think. In 1980, the networks called the presidency for Ronald Reagan and against Jimmy Carter while the West Coast was still voting. And there were a lot of complaints, specifically in California, that it seemed to depress turnout, that they actually saw, you know, anecdotal evidence of people like pulling into the parking lot, listening to the radio, and then just, you know, turning around and not voting. So, but, you know, Reagan would have carried California either way, so I don't think it changed it, but there were a lot of people that felt, the West Coast got, you know, that it was the networks, by the way, Carter conceded before the network, before California closed. That was the big, outcry.
All right.
That he should not have done
and there are
affected
some,
the down ballot races.
Yes,
right.
Yes, it did.
There are some folks who will insist that the Republicans would not have won the Senate if either the projections or Mr. Carter had held out any longer. a sweep that big, I'm not necessarily so sure that's the case. For one thing, Democrats didn't just lose a bunch of Western states in the Senate. They also, I mean, Hum and Talmadge was defeated in Georgia that year. The Republicans picked up seats in Alabama and Florida that they didn't have before. Really, from the myth is out there, but if you look at the gains the Republicans made on the East Coast in 1980, it works pretty much in tandem with what they did on the West Coast. So I'm not entirely certain that that is the case. I mean, in 1964, they were still voting for 3 hours in California when the CBS anchor stated, "The Republican Party is dead." That's a lot worse than what anybody did to the Democrats in 1980.
Reagan's coattails in 19. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and the Republicans actually still managed to flip a Senate seat in California that year as Goldwater's getting waxed. So, Reagan's coattails were pretty deep and they were pretty wide. It wasn't just in Western states that heard he'd already won before they finished voting.
Yeah, his coattails were like a wedding dress train that year, which would have been a great line if I could have gotten it out.
No, it's still funny.
In terms of Super Tuesday, so you know, we'll save our projections for the end of the show, as we normally do. But it's quite apparent to everyone who can add, you know, three digits at a time, that Hillary Clinton is going to end Super Tuesday about 300 delegates above the required amount that she needs to win the election, maybe by June 14th, 400 delegates. She's going to
Does D.C. have that many delegates?
No. Because it might be 350 by the end of Tuesday.
350. Night. Yeah, okay, that's fine.
Yeah. So she's going to be somewhere between 300 and 400 delegates ahead by the end of the whole process. Unless she somehow gets really beaten badly in California, which the polls are not suggesting, she'll still have, you know, a 2.8 million to 3.3 million vote lead in the raw popular vote. She will have won more states unless she gets, you know, routed on Tuesday, unless Bernie sweeps the table.
Which I don't think any of us see happening. So long as she holds those super delegates between now and July, and I don't see any reason why she wouldn't. I mean,
well, that's what I want to talk about. Yeah, that's what I want to talk about. So,
unless she is in an orange jumpsuit with an iron mask or a Hannibal Lecter mask for a federal crime, then no, all those delegates are going to stay with her. And let's be honest, it's not going to happen.
It's not going to be all of them. I'm actually going to predict here that there will be anywhere from a half dozen to a dozen. Not enough to change the outcome, I'm saying.
But really?
there will probably be, I think, about a half dozen to a dozen who will be under pressure from their low pressure and stuff, and they may sort of whisper back up and say, "Hey, can I make the jump without it really causing a problem?" We see this in Congress all the time. You get vulnerable congressmen who the leadership essentially say, "Yeah, you go ahead and vote against us, and it's okay." There'll probably be about no more than a dozen of those superdelegates who will make that switch. It'll be enough to energize the Sanders people. It'll be enough to keep them charging at the windmill. But so long as Mrs. Clinton holds the superdelegates she has, and I see no reason why she wouldn't, she'll be the nominee in July.
You know, that's the smart thing. That would be the smart thing that someone would say. Hey, let's give them a little bit. Let's throw them a bone here or there. But I can't see anybody in the Clinton campaign saying, "Oh, you know what? We're forgiving.
It's not about the Sanders people. It's about individual particularly say the electeds and the superdelegates.
Right, exactly.
Folks who are, say, facing a nasty primary challenge and who need to say, and who could probably solve their primary challenge issues by flipping over to Bernie. It's going to be one of those where there would be some discussions with the campaign. The campaign would come back. There'd be some back and forth. And maybe a few of them will be basically said, "Okay, yeah, you have the permission to flip so that you can hang around because we know the rest of them aren't moving."
Right.
Like I said, it's not going to be very many. It's going to be folks who are really under a strain and push. Somebody actually like Wasserman Schultz, if she wasn't the DNC chair. But it's not going to be enough.
Someone
to
in that situation, yeah.
Someone
yeah.
in that situation, exactly.
Right.
And I don't know the Democratic. I don't know the dimensions of the Democratic primary races well enough to know who, if any, who is in that kind of situation right now. But that's outside of that. It will be what it'll be like. And unfortunately, I mean, it couldn't be with us tonight. It'll be a lot like what we see in Virginia Republican conventions, where you will get. Basically, everybody sits and waits and has to sit and wait until the convention is held. You have the favorite who has the delegates on their side. Usually in ours, it's they have to claim it because nobody can actually track 10,000 delegates. In this case, it's a little easier, and it's just always a question: can they hold them? Can they hold them? Can they hold them? Again, based on what I think is going to happen Tuesday, she will hold them. It's going to be fine, but you know. Bernie's got money to blow through, so he can probably spend a month charging at some windmills and then figuring out what to do with this the movement in mid-July.
Right. Well, first of all, he wants to spend June and July continuing to give rallies. I don't know whether you guys caught that today.
Yeah.
But his plan is to continue going around the country and holding rallies and campaigning as if there's still a campaign going on. Now, of course, I think everybody would say, look, he has every right to have prosecuted this campaign. He certainly has a right to stay in through California and probably through D.C. But, Jonah and Greg, I'm curious what you think of this potential for him to continue to prosecute the case aggressively right up until, you know, the July, I think, 20th vote at the Democratic convention.
Well, I think it's the confidence aspect of it. I think that a lot of it is just optics. That if he just says, "Well, as of this date, after the last primary, then I'm not going to do anything," that sort of shows that he's anticipating not needing to do anything.
It's like that girlfriend when you try to break up with her, she says, "No, we're not broken up. We're still going together." You know, no matter what.
I think there's a part of that. And then the other thing that I've been talking about around this house and in our show is that he's not a Democrat. This is where we see what his intentions really are. You know, it's the idea is when the votes are finally cast and Hillary Clinton wins, which she will. Will he then say, "You know what? I now endorse you, and I'm going to go out there and just beat the crap out of Trump for being an ass"? Then that is one option. And the other option is, "I don't care about your damn votes. I'm going to be president of something, and you better watch." And that's a possibility too. I think that everything changes at that point. I think that if he goes down that second path, then all of his supporters have a big decision to make.
One, I love your Bernie Sanders impression. I think it's excellent. the Texas twang. I think it's kind of a Ron Paul Bernie Sanders. Two, I think I've heard this plan that he's doing it, and I heard the People for Ethical Treatment for Animals have already started to boycott it because he's just kicking a dead horse over and over and over. I mean, it's just ridiculous. And I think at some point, even the diehards are going to be like, "We get it. It's not going to happen. Stop trying to make this a thing." And there's only so many 24-hour news cycles that are going to take him seriously.
Well, I agree. And here's my several problems with what he's doing. First of all, as I spoke to last week and probably a few times on this show, I think a lot of people don't realize that in 2008, yes, some superdelegates did switch from Hillary Clinton to Barack Obama, but it's much, much fewer than people seem to think. There were really only altogether 28 superdelegates that switched from Hillary Clinton to Barack Obama in 2008. And about 15 of those flipped after Hillary Clinton had privately sent out the message through Democratic circles that she was going to withdraw from the race. So, in reality, only about 13 superdelegates ever switched sides while there was an active campaign going on. The other problem that I have with this idea of 300 superdelegates potentially flipping sides is these people have been canvassed not only by the individual campaigns, but by CNN and MSNBC and AP, who have the lists, have the phone numbers and the names, and they call them regularly and say, are you still committed to your candidate? In most cases, Hillary Clinton. And from what they are reporting, and I just heard this today, I believe on MSNBC or CNN, one of those networks said, our reporting says that no one is showing any inkling of switching sides. Now, does that mean that no one will? Of course not. There's always someone who may be vacillating but doesn't want to say it publicly, or may change their mind after they see what happens on Tuesday. But it's not going to be 300. And so here's my big problem with it. If, let's say you have two people running for president, a general election, and election night, one of the candidates has 280 electoral votes, has won 300 more electoral, excuse me, has won 3 million more votes, and has won more states. Does the other guy say, the person that's in second say, well, hey, I'm not going to, you know, say anything until the electors actually vote in December, because some of these electors may change their mind. They're not bound to vote the way their states went, which, by the way, is a fact. But right. No one in the history of presidential politics has ever done that. When there is a clear outcome, as there is in this particular campaign, you concede, you graciously call your opponent and congratulate them on their victory, and then you make a concession speech. You don't say, well, I'm going to wait around and see what the electors do 3 months from now, because it hurts the process, it hurts the winning candidate, and it's bad sportsmanship.
It hurts the party, too.
Let me re-enter the conversation here. First of all, superdelegates have been around since 1984. The Electoral College has been around since 1788. And in fact, we have seen, and granted it's been a while, but we have seen a history of shenanigans with the Electoral College. In fact, it was why Thomas Jefferson was elected vice president in 1796 rather than Pickering. Because Hamilton tried to get electors, Federalist electors, to vote against Adams, so that Timothy Pickering could end up getting elected president. And electors in New England got so pissed off, they said, no, we're going to vote for Adams and Jefferson just to cheese you off, Alex. And that's what ended up that Thomas Jefferson became vice president, and the rest is history. Now, I would say, as someone who has been involved in nomination processes that involve delegates that can change their mind, do I expect enough delegates to change their mind to give Bernie the nomination? No, I'd be shocked if that happens. I'd be as shocked about it as the rest of you. But the notion, and at some point, maybe somebody talks to Bernie and says, look, it's just not going to happen. These people are not going to change their minds. But the idea that an additional month of Bernie going out there and making himself hoarse is somehow going to get Donald Trump elected president of the United States is a complete fallacy. I'm sorry, it's just not going to happen.
But do you know the worst part about it is, though? Is that every time I talk to a 22-year-old, okay, or even a 42-year-old, who says, this isn't going to happen, right? It's just not going to happen. They say, it will if you believe, or...
And they go,
you just don't have faith. Or, you know what? That's your problem. You're jaded. You have no answer. And they sit there and go, and they say, you're not part of the revolution. You're the problem.
Greg, here's the problem. Here is the problem that you have to face, and why you just have to sit back and wait. Because the one word that you want to give them, and the word that will quiet most of them, is a word you cannot give them until July 24th, assuming the nomination is on Wednesday. And that word is scoreboard. Well, until the score actually goes up on the board, until they actually cast their vote, you can't say that. Now, you and I both know what's going to happen.
No, that's not true. That's not true.
Yes, it is.
See, because
Kevin, they haven't voted yet. Just because we
haven't you seen Rudy?
Just because we all know, just
neither do electors on November 8th. They don't vote until December. But we don't sit around wondering who's going to be the president. We have a president.
Oh, really? How many times did you pray to your version of the divinity? Which I don't know. I don't know your religion. Well, Greg is Catholic. I think you're Jewish.
I'm Catholic.
Kevin. I don't really care. My point is,
I'm a hockey fan.
Okay, fine. How often did you pray to the ghost of Gordie Howe that
he's still alive?
He is? Okay, see?
Yes.
Basketball. My point is, are you really telling me that you weren't hoping for some faithless electors in 2000 to throw it to Congress?
Was I hoping for that? No, I don't think I was hoping for that.
Really?
2000 is not an apt. 2000 is not an apt analogy because in 2000, Florida was still undeclared, undecided until Catherine Harris certified it. And when Catherine Harris certified it, the election was over.
Yeah, and even I accepted it at that point. Even when it went to the Supreme Court, I was like, you know, guys, we just have to take this one. You know, I did not complain.
To hang on to 2000 that's letting the exception be the rule. Come on, we've got 30 years of presidential electoral politics, and with the exception of 2000, when one person conceded and then took back his concession, it is always the loser concedes when the votes are counted and it's obvious that the other person will be elected by the electors in December. They don't wait until December for that to happen. And by the way, DJ, I believe you know this, but let me put this fact out there. In the Electoral College, no matter how a state votes, the electors do not have to follow that. They are not bound by that.
There can be,
so it's very analogous.
There can be and there have been faithless electors. However, the simple fact of the matter is the superdelegates don't have the history of the Electoral College. And while I certainly agree with you that this is not going to happen, until it actually doesn't happen, these people who have largely never been involved in a nomination process, they haven't gone through it like you or I have, they will convince themselves we can change their minds. It will be a month-long campaign aimed at 600 people. And unfortunately, as much as you don't want to do this, you may very well have to wait until those 600 people get together on the 24th of July and tell him no.
No, I think we will have to wait. I think you're right. But what I think Greg and I would respond to that is that this is going to hurt the Democratic Party because then she can't start putting the pieces of the party together until the day of her acceptance speech. And what you're going to have at the convention is, you know, if Bernie Sanders goes into that convention with 1,700 delegates and some large portion of them actually believe that he has a chance of winning, these are people that are going to be booing Hillary Clinton's acceptance speech, turning their back on her like the police turned their back on Mayor de Blasio in New York. They're going to be walking out of the convention while she's making her speech. There are going to be protesters outside. I saw people outside of the Sanders rally yesterday telling us about their very detailed logistical plans already to protest in Philadelphia. It's going to be a mess. And that is why he's jeopardizing her chances to get elected. And you don't do that to your party. And if he does that, he's the biggest asshole in politics.
Well, hang on.
And that includes Donald Trump.
We don't know. Okay, that's funny. We don't know what Bernie Sanders himself is actually going to do.
It was not meant to be funny.
I know. But we don't know what Bernie Sanders is actually going to do on Thursday. That fact, that's frankly, is one of the wild cards of all this. We don't know what he is going to do. He may very well say, on June 15th, I fought the good fight, I've kept the faith. He may say it on July 24th or July 25th. He may do something entirely different. The point is, we don't know what he is going to do. If Bernie Sanders warmly endorses Hillary Clinton on July 25th, then whoever those people are who are planning all this sort of thing, there'll be a story for about a day or two, and then most people will move on. But the simple fact of the matter is, this is something that, again, they have to cast their votes. Everybody knew that Hubert Humphrey was going to be the nominee in 1968, but they had to cast the votes first for him to get the nomination. And I will humbly submit, having looked, and granted, I was -4 in 1968, but the simple fact of the matter is, Hubert Humphrey actually got all of those people back when he said, I want a bombing halt in Vietnam.
Get enough of them because he fell 500,000 votes short of winning.
But the people that, for lack of a better term, caused the problems in 1968, he got them back. The people he couldn't get back were the ones who voted for George Wallace. They were gone to the Democratic Party. They were never coming back, but nobody knew it because they had actually waited for the votes to be cast in 1968. The anti-war movement wasn't Hubert Humphrey's problem. He won them over.
Okay.
He did.
Well, that's a debate for another time in another 40 minutes.
That may very well be true. But the fact of the matter is, this is the Democratic Party is probably not going to come together until sometime in July. But I can assure you from over on my end that they are not going to face a united Republican Party, because it's a Republican Party that doesn't have meaning anymore. I'm actually looking at something from a Nebraska newspaper that says Senator Ben Sasse is looking at possibly voting for Gary Johnson, and he said he will not vote for Trump or for Clinton, and I guarantee you there's not going to be a United States Senator on the Democratic side of the aisle, except for maybe Bernie Sanders, unless if he decides to go really off on his own, in which case none of us are right on this. But assuming Bernie Sanders does what we think he does, which is will eventually come and support the nominee, you're not going to have a sitting United States Senator on the Democratic side voting for Jill Stein. You will, it looks like, have at least one U.S. Senator on the Republican side voting for Gary Johnson or somebody else. The Democrats
You're using them as a microcosm of the voting public, and I'm not sure that that's an apt comparison.
Well, no, but
why don't we move on?
But do you know who is voting for Trump now? Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan.
He has been.
Go ahead.
Von Poppenized.
I love that word.
And for those of you, and for those of you who do not have my age or my obsession with obscure political lingo, that is a reference to Franz von Papen, who was in fact the German politician who convinced President Hindenburg and the various other leading lights in the Weimar Republic of Germany, that Adolf Hitler was a safe pair of hands as chancellor, and that there were enough good people around him who were not Nazis who would keep him under control. The rest is tragedy, including the dirigible that bared the president's name. So the simple fact
is there, and is there a funnier phrase in history than President Hindenburg?
If you're looking at dark tragic humor, yes, there is, where Von Papen says, "Don't worry about Hitler, we hired him, it's going to be okay." That was some pretty tragic humor right there. And if you looked at what Ryan said, and I actually looked at the piece Ryan had, it almost read like German to me. It was horrifying. It was, yeah, Donald Trump's a bit of a wild card, we don't know what he's doing, but we have an agenda, and he's our best vehicle for the agenda. Well, frankly, if Donald Trump is the best vehicle for your agenda, then you have a problem with your agenda, or you have a problem with your roadmap, or you certainly have a problem with figuring out what car to drive.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm sure I could see Ryan and McConnell sitting around going, I think we can do this. I think he'll get us the votes, and I'm pretty sure we can control him, because I don't think he's that smart. I think we can do this. And I'm sure Trump is laughing at both of them. You know, it's pretty, I would say funny, but wait, that's not the word. Oh, horrifying. That's the word.
Yeah.
Horrifying. Especially with what Trump just said about this judge recently. Is that where you heard, Kevin?
Yeah, yeah. He had probably his worst week since he's become a politician.
Oh, since last week. How's that?
He said his worst week since last week.
But so Trump, you know, is upset about the Trump University lawsuit, and this week said a few in politic things about the judge who happens to be of Mexican descent, who is sitting on the case, and by gosh, then he doubled down on it today by saying on one of the Sunday talk shows that somebody asked him, well, if it had been a Muslim judge, do you think that they might be somehow politically, or excuse me, judicially prejudiced towards you? And he said, yeah, probably, maybe, yeah. So he is working to get, you know, 0% of the Latino vote, 0% of the Muslim vote. He's going to have to clone angry white men from now until election day.
With all due respect, Kevin, there was nothing that you said that was necessarily wrong, but I think you were being far too analytical about this. We need to actually take a step back, and recognize what Donald Trump actually did. First of all, this is not about the fact that Trump got confused about where the guy was born, which was the initial assumption when this thing spewed out. John Podhoretz actually had a great column about Trump's lingo and the way he talks. He basically says everything about him screams 1963. He uses Rat Pack lingo all over the place. He drops Yiddish in wherever he can. And back then, we didn't in New York at least in 1963, you would certainly know this, Kevin, as growing up in the area. We didn't hyphenate ethnic groups. We didn't call them Irish American. We called them Irish and Italian and Polish and Mexican. He was basically saying, it wasn't just about this judge. He was basically saying any American of Mexican descent cannot, quote, treat him fairly, unquote. He essentially disqualified an entire ethnic group from the public square. And then he did it with a religious group, as you mentioned earlier this morning. He is basically trying to say these people can be decent Americans and those people can't. We've never seen anything this open and this blatant, arguably, since the rum, Romanism, and rebellion line that was used against Grover Cleveland in 1884. And there's a whole bunch of racist examples that can be used between then and now that just not coming to, for whatever reason, they're not coming into my head. My point is, this is something that we really have not seen in about 40 to 50 years. Forget dog whistles. Forget implications. He's actually saying that Mexican-Americans can't be trusted, that Muslim-Americans can't be trusted.
This judge was actually born in Indiana.
Greg.
And that's amazing.
But that has nothing to do with it. Donald Trump knew damn well where he was born. It wasn't about where he was born. It was about an entire ethnic group.
But when I hear Mexican judge, my age group, I actually think, oh, it's a judge from Mexico.
Right, but that's the point. The point
is exactly the point.
It's not about what you hear. It's about what he is saying. And you have to take what he's saying and translate it from his language, which is 1960s New York, into 21st century American. What does he mean? What he means is no Mexican American can be trusted in the public square.
Well, that's as a presidential candidate, though, he doesn't get that by that we have to translate his words into what we think he means. He has to be judged, no pun intended, on the actual words he says. But listen, since we are coming short on time, I'm curious about Joner. There's my New York accent. Jonah. Jonah Nevada. Jonah's take on the election, and what I believe you've got a name for that, Jonah.
Well, I'd like to take a moment to talk about the Libertarian Party. And
do we have a song for this? And
Jonah's Libertarian Corner, I think we're calling this.
It runs through my mind. I've decided that I'm going to vote for Gary Johnson for president.
As am I.
And this is part of the larger Electoral College issue because, you know, whether I'm voting in Maryland or California, the state's going to go in one direction. So it doesn't really matter. I'm throwing away my vote to vote for a Democrat or Republican, really. I mean, we all agree with that. So I'd like to move on with the larger journey that I'm on is this just a fling? am I just going to like kind of date Gary for a little while, or do I really want to get involved? So I've been working on, you know, reading through the platform. I'm just going to read you a little bit of the preamble of the libertarian platform. As libertarians, we seek a world of liberty. Say, good so far.
Oh, yeah.
A world in which all individuals are sovereign over their own lives and no one is forced to sacrifice his or her values for the benefit of others. We believe that respect for individual rights is the essential precondition for a free and prosperous world, that force and fraud must be banished from human relationships, and that only through freedom can peace and prosperity be realized. And I just want to, everyone, you know, from now on, I'm going to read a little bit from the Libertarian Party platform in each episode, I think, just to remind us that there are options out there, and maybe the people that we think are crazy aren't as crazy as we think.
Did it say from personal relationships?
Yes. Yes, the Libertarian Party can help you banish fraud from human relationships.
You know, because I had this girlfriend who, like, not only cheated on me, but, like, cheated on me with, like, everybody. So
you should have been libertarian.
But if I was a libertarian, that would have stopped her. Like, somehow?
Well, you would have... You would have recognized
that you had the freedom to walk away, just as I recognized I had the freedom to walk away from my horrific relationship with the Republican Party, just as I'm trying to convince poor Emily to walk away from her horrific relationship to the Republican Party. Because, as I've said, there is life after the Republican Party. I put it in a post earlier. But
it's called the Democratic Party.
No, I'm sorry, it's not. But the simple fact of the matter is, it's not just the fact, I mean, it certainly helps that we are dealing with arguably the two most disliked major presidential party candidates in a very long time, suddenly both being on the ballot at the same time. But I think it also, especially for those of us who were Republicans, because we are looking at a party completely change direction on us, this really is the chance to take a look at the libertarians. And particularly in California, where, let's face it, the libertarians pretty much have a very good chance of actually becoming the second party, because the Republicans have been essentially dead there for about 10 years. This is really the chance for the libertarians to say, look, there is an alternative to Trump or Clinton. But for a lot of folks, particularly in the center and on the right, who are in a crisis in a way that the Democrats simply are not, they can look and they can say, look, we actually have an alternative to the Republican Party. And that's certainly one of the reasons why I'm supporting Johnson and Weld. It's why I will probably support the Libertarian nominee for governor 2017, but that's another show. And it's why I myself am seeing that journey that I probably will end up calling myself a capital L Libertarian before the year's over. I'm not quite there yet, but I'm getting closer. I'll tell you the truth.
We defend each person's right to engage in any activity that is peaceful and honest, and welcome the diversity that freedom brings.
Let me ask you guys a question. So the issues with the Republican Party kind of started with the Tea Party and how, you know, and all that kind of right-wing evangelical and all these things about 4 or 5 years ago, give or take. Maybe even longer.
No.
Maybe?
No. You're... You are simplifying, but that's when the Tea Party initially popped up in 2009, 2010, and I know because I knew a number of tea brewers at the time. They were singularly focused on economic issues. I actually spoke to the head of the Tea Party in my particular county at the time. I was trying to gauge his thing on, and he said he would be willing to join the Republican Committee, willing to help the Republican, but he said, but I do not want any discussions on social issues because they are a distraction from the real problems we face. And I remember being so happy when I heard that.
Well,
but the simple fact of the matter is that that's not what the Tea Party devolved into.
Right.
What you are seeing is what I've called it repeatedly, it's tax hiking Republicans using weapons of mass distraction.
Well, the question I have is, are we going to see the progressives right now, the Sanders people, in 4 or 5 years split the Democratic Party? the neoliberals, which I'm using air quotes because I think that's kind of a ridiculous term, right-wing liberals and the progressive liberals tear the party apart in 4 years from now or 8 years from now, because these kids who don't know how to register to vote in a primary are going to figure it out eventually.
Yeah, that's really more a question for you and Kevin than for Joan and myself. Looking at the party from the outside, I can't see it happening because, again,
what do you think,
from
Kevin?
My
you were with all those kids the other night in their Sanders, pot smoking den of opium and Susan Sarandon. What do you think?
What's the question again? I'm sorry, I was.
I know. Whenever I talk, you
no, it was my fault.
You blank out. Where do you think that in 4 or 5 years that the progressive Sanders movement will break up the Democratic Party, much like we're seeing the Republican Party have a crisis and this breakup?
Five-word answer, not a chance in hell.
Okay.
Personally, I don't think that's going to happen to the Republican Party either. This goes back to conversations that we had. And specifically between me and DJ before he officially left the Republican Party. I think that whatever happens in this election, things are going to go back to the status quo, more or less, in 2020 and beyond. That, again, could be wrong, but that's my opinion.
Oh, cool. Oh. Cool. All right.
So, well, shall we go to predictions about Tuesday?
Let's go to predictions about Tuesday. What do you guys think is going to happen, DJ?
I will say Sanders may win one or two of the prairie states, but Hillary beats him in New Jersey. Hillary beats him in California. Hillary probably beats him in New Mexico as well. And then she will claim a mandate from the Democratic Party and the Democratic voters. I don't know how long it takes for that to sink in with Sanders himself. It may take a week. It may take a month. I don't know. But what he needs to be viable is a victory in California. Well, that's what he needs to be, at least to get to life support. He's not getting it.
Okay. What do you think? Mm. What do you think, Kevin?
Hillary is going to win New Jersey. She's going to win New Mexico. Bernie is going to win South Dakota, North Dakota, and Montana. I still give Hillary a slight edge in California, but regardless of how California turns out, my prediction is she's going to have about 320 to 350 delegate lead by the end of that night. And a further prediction is that by the end of the week, more superdelegates will have moved to her, and also more uncommitted delegates will have moved to her. And I think that by the end of voting on June 14th or June 15th, the next day, she'll have a 400-delegate lead.
Jonah?
Yeah, I think I agree with most of that. The liberal strain in South Dakota, North Dakota, and Montana is particularly rambunctious. It's like Oklahoma. Like you're like, really? There's a history of socialism in North Dakota? Oh yeah, man.
Oh yeah, there is. Oh yeah.
So that's cool. I would be very surprised if Sanders won California. I didn't think it would be as close as maybe, you know, if you squint at it and you look a certain way, maybe it looks close. But I would be pretty surprised if it got that close. And then really all that I'm looking to see is really what Sanders does next, because, a long time ago, I think Hillary Clinton, really, there was no debate. There was no debate. It would just had to wait till we got to the end. And I don't know that we're at the end.
Wow. That's pretty deep.
Greg, what about you?
I think because as Sanders says, it's all about momentum. And Hillary has just come off all these wins. She's going to use it, and she's going to win it all. It's done. And she is going to win the Prairie State. She is going to win South Dakota. She is going to
really?
Win South Dakota. I do.
Wow.
I think at this point, everyone is done, and it's done. But the one surprising thing that you guys haven't said is I think Wednesday, Elizabeth Warren is going to endorse her, too.
Yeah, I think Thursday you're going to see Warren possibly come out, and I think you're going to see Obama and Biden very soon after.
Right. It's going to be, and I think Obama's going to endorse her Tuesday night. I mean, I think as soon as the polls close and as soon as it's going to be like, oh, yeah, here's my official press release. Congratulations, you're the presumptive. Here's my endorsement. Are we done? Kick the door down. Drop the mic.
I think he and Biden will probably have to wait until after D.C. votes because it'd be impolitic to preclude them. But I think Warren might move a little quicker.
I would agree. They may wait until after
oh,
D.C.
did I forget D.C. like
yes,
everybody
you,
else?
You forgot D.C. and Democratic activists don't forget D.C., so they will probably wait. And then we will see how many Democrats are unhappy with this president. I don't think it'll be zero. I don't think it'll be a lot. But if he endorses after D.C., you'll start to see a little tension. Nothing like on the and by the way, on the Republican side, Trump will pass 1,500 if not six. Well, he can't pass 1,600, but he will certainly pass 1,500 on Tuesday. And I will have another attempt to convince Emily to just get out.
Get out. Excellent. So,
and for those of you who are listening, and I'm pretty sure it's more than just one, don't forget to find us at moreperfectunionpodcast.com, which will include blogs and commentary. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/moreperfectunionpodcast. And, of course, rate and review us on iTunes and share our link on your news feed.